This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The Week in Review on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that puts the media and the news in the spotlight. This week, we have a report on a regional workshop on media ethics. But before that, we have three stories from Asia Calling. Thais are living in exile to escape martial law. Afghanistan has its first ever amusement park. And in India, a car that runs on water. Martial law has brought calm but not peace to Thailand. That's the finding of a report by the International Crisis Group. The report warns that the military regime's stifling of dissent could lead to greater unrest in the future. The military claimed that the coup was staged in order to maintain order after 6 months of street protests by anti-government protesters. It has since squashed all forms of dissent. They took TV channels and radio stations off air, and only heavily censored versions have been allowed to return. Several hundred academics and activists have been detained. And as Kanika Pechkau reports from the US, many others have fled to the West, where they're applying for asylum.
From his new home in America, John Pepperdap makes a Skype call home to his nephew.
He tells them he's doing fine in the US and says, "Don't worry about me, just go to school and do your best."
After he hangs up, he says he was just putting on brave face.
"It is not fine at all, but I prefer to stay here where I can have freedom of expression and I can do my work without any interfere or suppression."
John Pepperdap left Thailand right after the military coup in May this year. He worked as a journalist for more than 30 years in Thailand. But after the coup, he felt there was no point staying. The media was no longer free. Because he gave airtime to controversial figures, including former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra, he feared that he would be jailed.
"I can't help feeling nervous about what's going to happen now if my asylum claim is not granted. But I have heard that my case is being processed and I can stay here even when my tourist visa runs out."
In San Francisco is Charupong Rueungsuwan, the former Minister of Interior in the party Thaksin founded. Charupong fled the country with his family weeks after the coup and now live in America, waiting for the asylum. He says he spends his time online talking to the people back in Thailand.
"I enjoy talking through Line application. I am now addicted to it and also the internet. With freedom of expression here, I can research anything and talk about any topic. Thais cannot do this."
The military junta has put out an arrest warrant for him. He is facing three charges: disobeying the junta's summons, violating the Computer Act, and libel. And if he returns to Thailand, he will likely to jail.
"I'm 68 now, but will go on fight. I don't mean in the radical way. We will just keep speaking out and letting the whole world know the truth and push for change. The world won't tolerate the dictatorships. Thai people have never tolerated dictatorship. They just cannot say the truth because guns are pointed at them. Guns and weapons paid for by the people's sweat and hard work."
Krisuda Kunasan was an anti-government protester who was detained by the military for 30 days. She says she was blindfolded and then beaten and sexually harassed. Once released, she was helped out of the country. Now she is in Norway and is living in asylum seekers' transit home.
"When I arrived 4 months ago, I feel so depressed and overwhelmed with fear and anger. I can't speak their language. I don't know what will happen and what life will be like here. Things are getting a bit better now with the support of lots of people, and I am getting settled in and starting to be optimistic. I felt very fortunately that I could quickly flee. What I gain here is a new life. I have freedom here. It's amazing that another country has helped me. Why my own country has done the opposite to their people?
Reporting from the United States of America, this is Kanika Petkel for Asia Calling.
Afghanistan's capital city of Kabul has the country's first ever amusement park. It's called Kabul City Park. Thousands have visited the park since it opened in October, with peak visiting times on Friday afternoon after the Islamic day of prayer. Gayo Waziri went along.
There are long lines to get inside the barbed wire security fence and into the park. Children in bright clothes clutch their parents' hands and hop from foot to foot in anticipation. Inside is a rare escape from war and suicide attacks and soldiers. 9-year-old Fakhruddin gushes as he gets inside. Squealing children hardly know where to go first. There are large, friendly characters that look almost like Minnie Mouse and Tom, the cat from Tom and Jerry. And then there are the classic rides, a Ferris wheel and bumper cars, and then there is a crystal and face painting. 17-year-old Ahmad has just come off the dragon shape.
City Park is really nice and by far the best thing in Kabul. There's nothing else like it. I like every ride, but the spacecraft was the best. It's wonderful hearing people shouting for joy all around.
For 2 days of the week, the place is only for women and children. The other days, everyone is welcome. Parveen Rahmati, who is a kindergarten teacher in Kabul City, is one of those women who come to the city park with her family to spend her time and have entertainment.
We wanted our children to have some joy. We have spent 2 hours here and are very entertained. I would like to see more parks like this all over Afghanistan. I really like the rules that this park has, and it's very safe and in a good condition.
Kabul, a city of 6 million people, is a virtual fortress. Major buildings are protected by concrete and barbed wire, and roads are choked with traffic. Armed security forces guard almost every street corner. Afghanistan has been at war for more than 30 years, and while U.S. and NATO combat troops prepare to leave by the end of 2014, the Taliban insurgency shows no sign of abating. Few families in Kabul have been untouched by the violence, says Habibullah Ismati, the park's general manager.
The business's aim is to abolish sorrow from our people's mind, even if it is for a short time. It's very clear that our people desire entertainment. We have had around 3 until 5,000 visitors a day.
The park is set on 10 hectares owned by the Kabul municipal government and leased for 5 years to a private company. Khojman Ulumi, the municipal deputy, says that $1.5 million has been invested in the park, with local government taking 26% of profits. He says the government will support more such parks.
In the past, we haven't had a park like this, and our children's minds are full of war. We want to create new memories for children and show them that the future is bright without war. The park has been very popular, and we see lots of happy visitors and hear shouts of joy. This really makes us happy. We have received another proposal for other amusement parks that are even better than this one.
17-year-old Ahmad has spent hours inside the park and is now heading home.
I feel like escaped from the news about blasts, suicide attacks, and the war.
Farisha Kaling, this is Ghayr Waziri from Kabul, Afghanistan.
In order to fight increasing petrol prices, a garage owner in India has modified his car so that it can run on water. He says the car's energy is created with the help of hydrogen and oxygen and a small tank of water that is fitted in the engine of the car. He claims he's able to drive 75 kilometers on just 1 liter of water. Jasvinder Sigal went for a test drive in his hometown of Surat in the state of Gujarat.
In front of Purushottam Pipalia's garage is a petrol station, but he never needs to go there. This is how he claims he fills up his car. He takes a drink from the water bottle and then pours the rest into his car. He says that half a liter of water will be enough to get him back home. He opens the bonnet to show me how it works.
This is the device by which the water is broken into hydrogen and oxygen. This power regulator and battery also help in the process. As soon as you put on the engine, within 2 minutes, the hydrogen gets released and creates the energy. In other hydrogen cars, the gas is directly pumped into the car, but here the hydrogen comes from water, making it very safe.
We get in and drive.
It took 15 years for me to develop this technology. The hydrogen does not only increase the fuel efficiency, but also the power efficiency.
Purushottam takes me to his home in a special car. His wife, Varsha Ben, is doing her morning Hindu prayers. She then prepares tea and tells me how her prayers have been answered.
When he drives his water car, I feel very good. This is all due to the blessing of our God.
Her son, Jignesh Pipalia, helps in the garage.
I want to see my father's invention come to the market. It will relieve people from the increasing price of fuel. His invention is unique.
But Purushottam faces a problem in terms of selling cars like this. In India, hydrogen cars are illegal. The government is concerned about safety.
In India, the manufacturing of hydrogen car is yet not permissible. As my car engine runs only on fresh hydrogen, so a special approval is required. I am eagerly waiting for this. Once I get it, then all the people will be able to run their vehicles on water.
Next year, international car manufacturer Toyota is releasing a hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicle. In the United Kingdom, a network of 15 hydrogen filling stations will be in place by the end of 2015 as part of major investment by the government in the technology. Purushottam has patented his invention in Germany. He's sure that his inventions may have far-reaching effects on the automobile industry at home and abroad.
My dream is that my technology should extend worldwide. It will improve the economy of the world.
For Asia Calling, this is Jaswinder Sehgal in Surat, India.
Jai Mataji.
Jai Mataji.
Asia Calling was produced by Kanto Brita Radio and I'm Lapanha in Jakarta. Next up, we present a report from a regional workshop on media ethics. I'm Sharad Kutan and you're listening to The Week in Review, BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutan and The Week in Review continues. The subject of media ethics, while urgent, seems somewhat fuzzy when we talk about it in the abstract. We usually end up with a laundry list of do's and don'ts or platitudes about how the media should promote all things good. Yet it seems unavoidable. We need to articulate the core concerns of independence, balance, and public-spiritedness. I was in Thailand recently for a regional symposium on developing an ASEAN-level code of media ethics. It was initiated by the Thai Public Broadcasting Service. Interestingly, Thai PBS itself is a product of the democratic struggle in the kingdom. Currently, Thailand is run by a military junta that overthrew the caretaker government of Yingluck Shinawatra some 6 months ago. A reform council is drafting a new constitution, but it's a process that some say is not very inclusive or democratic. Somchai Sumvanban is Director General of Thai PBS. He invited me to observe a public consultation on the reform process. Now, Somchai also made clear that he was recently visited by members of the military government and told to stop the broadcast. Standing by the organization's charter, Somchai and team are continuing with the ninth and the last of the series, which they hope will inform the official process.
My name is Somchai Suwanban. I'm the Director General of Thai Public Broadcasting Service. This is the what we call public forum programs. We run a series of public forum in several places up and down the countries. This is part of the reform process in terms of the people voices for the reform process. As you know, Thailand is going through the transition of reforming, political reform. And the government appointed a reform council to work on how to work out a new constitution. So I think as a media, and then as we think that the people should have ownership of this new blueprint that's going to be a roadmap for Thailand the next many years. So what we try to do to get more voices from the cloud instead of those people who have been appointed and then who's been some of them quite academic or politician or government bureaucrat. But then we need the real voices from the people. So we go around up and down the country holding up public forum and then listen to them and put together what they think about the new process of reform, the new blueprint of Thailand is going to be. Then today is the last of the whole session. This is the number 9th series that we do. So we did the final one. This is come together from those several public forums that we did before and then come together and to put together a collective proposal for the Reform Council.
Is this an official process, a process endorsed by government?
No, we are running this on our own. And then we told the member of the Reform Council that we are going to do this. And then with some kind of misunderstanding, the military government got confused about the whole process and thought we are doing this as perhaps want to go against the new direction that they want to be. But I think we are trying to get more and more voices from the cloud to help them getting a proper blueprint for Thailand. So we think we are supporting the reform process. We are not against the reform process. So we have some difficulty before, but somehow we try to test the water bit by bit that we still can do our work as an independent media instead of government-controlled media.
How is the rest of Thai media responding to the Reform Council and this process of putting together a blueprint? Are they also doing such activities as you are?
There are one TV station doing something similar to us. But the government-controlled media haven't done this kind of series or program. So they do what the Reform Council or what the government say, that they have opened up discussion here and there. They also follow the activities. But what we are doing now is to get the real voices, genuine voices from the people. And those who have concern of the new blueprint is going to be, then we invite them to come together and put together their thought and their view. And then we have a collective view of the voices of people. And then we think that we can pass this proposal to the Reform Council so they can consider to put into the new blueprint, because the Reform Council will have already set up a constitution drafting committee. So we are worried that the new constitution not reflecting the voice of the people.
Now, Thai PBS is both independent but also funded by public money, I believe taxes from tobacco and alcohol. How do you maintain your independence from the government since they are the ones who control your money?
No, they're not control our money. The mechanism is, according to the law, 1.5% of the tobacco and alcohol revenue we have to transfer directly to the Thai PBS bank account every month. So we got this money on a monthly basis, and at the end of the year, we have to work out how much money we got, and then any surplus from the allocated budget, which is about 2,000 million baht or about 50 million US dollar a year, any surplus from that we have to transfer back to the government. So there's no government interference in our funding. This is the mechanism according to the law. So this way, we can get the politician out of the money that coming to money funding the Thai PBS operation.
there's a timeline for return to democratic politics and election. I believe it's in early 2016. Between now and that period, what is Thai PBS going to do? Is it going to give more space for discussion about that the future direction?
Yeah, we have two programs like this. We call Seeing Prachachon, Voice of the People on the direction of the reform. And we also have weekly program, 1 hour each. We call Public Arena, which the two main program, 2 hours a week, that we run this kind of public discussion. So these two program will continue to follow what the Reform Council proposal and discussion. We also have a public policy debate every week. So a lot of this public participation in our program, we have this kind of program much more than any other TV station in Thailand. And we will follow the policy, the new direction, or even the draft constitution. We'll have people voices to debate about what the proposal, the new constitution going to be. So we will follow all the way to in the next 12 or 18 months, what's going on, what's going to be Thailand's new blueprint.
Is the Thai media under a lot of pressure currently under this new government?
Many of the broadcasting media is under quite a lot of pressure. The print media is relatively more freedom. Among the broadcasting media, I think Thai PBS enjoy relatively more freedom of expression and more room to maneuver than any other station.
That was Somchai Suvanban, Director General of Thai PBS. If national level institutions struggle to maintain their independence and public spiritedness, how would this work on a regional level? I turn to veteran Thai journalist for his views on the project to develop a regional code of ethics.
Well, my name is Kuwi Tongkichatawon. I'm a columnist of The Nation.
Much of the discussion today, we couldn't separate media ethics from media systems and political systems. And it seems that there's a kind of confusion, at least on a conceptual level, about what media ethics really means. And how do you make that kind of separation?
I think it's very difficult to make a separation. But as you correctly mentioned, media ethics, media practice, actually it's a reflection of the political system. Most of the time, a political system in ASEAN produces the kind of media freedom. For example, as you can see, Philippines rank very high among ASEAN countries, Indonesia too, because they have a much more consolidated democracy. Thailand is not so good at the moment. At the lowest is Laos. Laos, as you can see, is run by a monolithic Communist Party. So I think you cannot separate from that. But what we are talking about this day, since all the countries are now come into one single community with still different standards, so you need to help build whatever common ethical standard that you can find, that you can identify, so that these, at this moment, still very narrow denominator, narrow path, could be widened in a future. It's a work in progress, so that in the future you will add up, make it broader. I think that way, that's we are aimed to build that kind of approach.
There are a lot of skeptics about ASEAN who say that ASEAN is essentially slowly, gradualist. I mean, they're more or less nasty words of describing this process. I mean, how do you defend the ASEAN tradition of change?
Oh, very easy. What would happen to the region without ASEAN? People talk about ASEAN as talk shop. People criticize ASEAN as very slow, no action, talk only, that sort of thing. But without ASEAN, the region could be worse. Without any representative, without any organization to represent 630 million's voice, so that we can bargain, can talk with the international communities. Certainly, ASEAN, the best description is a work in progress, is still bumpy, because You have 10 countries with different levels of economic developments and political system.
How would you relate the question of a code of ethics on a regional level with something like the human rights regional mechanism? Could there be a relationship between the two things?
Oh, there will be, because I think it's linked. Press freedom, human rights, democratic values, I think they are interlinked. Certainly in ASEAN at the moment, human rights is focused on promotion. Protection will come later, and I think they're moving into that kind of stage. You remember when ASEAN started the regional-wide security cooperation, they start talking about confidence building measure. Now they're moving toward preventive diplomacy. They have not yet reached the third step, that is conflict resolution. So the process in ASEAN is slow, but it's sure. Rather than the other region which moving very fast but not on a solid ground. So ASEAN is a little bit different in that sense.
Do you think essentially the struggle for media freedom or for an open kind of journalistic practice is a national one? That we, in fact, the struggle has to happen at a national one before it becomes a regional one?
Interesting. I would think so. It all starts out from the nationals. Basis and then widen into the regional consensus. When ASEAN get together, it was formed only through four or five countries that see things similarly. Then it was joined by CLMV, and soon enough it will be East Timor. So that kind of thing will start at the national level and then brought it into a regional level. I think that way the regionalization in ASEAN is much stronger. It can withstand external pressure longer.
Kavi, when you get involved in these talks, what is it that you hope can be achieved by them?
Well, we hope that ASEAN's media community will be much more connected. When they write, they have the sense of belonging, that they write for the common well-being of ASEAN as an entity. Because most of the time, ASEAN, when they write about, is really bilateral thinking, you know, what can we get from ASEAN, what benefit will come to us, that sort of thing. There's no sense of belonging to the whole community. I think that's what I would aim for.
You're one of the few people I know who really kind of can talk about ASEAN on an ASEAN level. I mean, you seem to have so much knowledge about the different countries. You've watched several conflicts, southern Philippines and Sabah. You've seen the conflict between Thailand and Cambodia, even in the southern Thai, northern peninsula yeah. issue. How have the media generally, you think, frame those conflicts? Have they been able to frame it in a way that promotes all the kinds of values that I've talked about in terms of ASEAN values?
Well, I don't think so. I think each country frame according to the national narrative of conflict. So southern Thailand, if you read Thai journalists writing about southern Thailand, it's all about the killing, nothing about social justice, you know, that sort of thing. And if you read the Malay press, it's sort of different. It was about the Thai state that trying to destroy the Malaysian identity, that sort of thing. So I think we have to overcome that kind of narrow narrative. So you need to bring the two cultures together so you understand cross-border dynamic, why this thing happened.
That was veteran Thai journalist Kawi Chongchitawon. Like the regional code of media ethics, the Week in Review is a work in progress. But I hope this morning's show has been food for thought. And remember, the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. I'm Sharad Kutan, and this is BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.